and welcome to this episode of What Will I Be When I Grow Up? Our guest today, Wole Talabi, is an engineer, writer, and editor from Nigeria. He is the author of the novel Shikiti and the Brass Head of Obalufon. His short fiction has appeared in places like Asimov Science Fiction, Lightspeed Magazine, Torah.com, and is collected in Convergence Problems and Incomplete Solutions. He has been a finalist for the Hugo Nebula Locus and Nomo Awards, as well as the Kane Prize for African Writing. He has edited 5 anthologies, including a 2-volume translation anthology in Bengali, African Futurism, and the forthcoming Mother Sound, the Sorcerer's Anthology. He likes scuba diving, elegant equations, and oddly shaped things. He currently lives and works in Malaysia. Hello, Wole. How are you today?
Mostly excellent. Thank you.
Good. That's a nice way to be. I'm very excited that you're here with us today. For the listeners, Wole and I are actually friends. We've known each other for, I guess, about 1 or 2 years now. Yeah. And I was really pleased to have the opportunity to talk to you about your life and your career. So if you've listened to the podcast, if you haven't, it's fine. You'll know that I normally start the podcast by asking my guests to tell me a little bit about themselves. So can we just start with, you know, you telling us about your childhood, maybe some snippets about school life and some key influences from that time?
Of course, yeah. it's a pleasure to be here to talk about myself, which is a bit weird, but good. So I grew up in Nigeria. I was born in a steel town. My dad was a chemical engineer, as am I. And he was one of the lead engineers in the Delta Steel Plant, which is now defunct. But we basically grew up around the steel plant. It was a really fascinating kind of company town where basically everyone in the compound worked for the steel plant. We all went to the same school. We played together, you know, ran around the neighborhood plucking fruits and things like that. So it was a very nice kind of like almost suburban life growing up. And during that time, I really enjoyed school. I think I've just always really enjoyed learning and finding things out, like discovering how the world works. I'm endlessly fascinated by the world. I say it all the time, like there's always some random bit of history or just weird observations about humanity and life that I make. And I was like, why is, like, this is weird. Walking is weird. Breathing is weird. Evolution is weird. Everything is interesting to me. So I've always been curious about the world. And so I really enjoyed school. I enjoyed studying. I went to secondary school in a town next to where the steel plant was. Actually, my family had to move away from the steel town, which was in Warri, because the government in Nigeria at the time was mostly incompetent and they ran the steel plant into the ground. So everything was going belly up. And so the family, my dad basically left the company, went to work for a fertilizer company in the state nearby. And that's where I went to secondary school. And there I kind of dug in quite a lot into academics, mostly studying. I kind of gave up a bit on sports and things like that. I was just focused on the books. I was the library prefect, so I was in charge of the books, literally.
And, that's massively nerdy. I love it.
Yes, I know. To give a bit of a funny story. So part of why I did that was the main reason I went to that school, apart from it being in the town where my family moved to, it was a bit of a fancy school. A bit expensive. And my older brother had gone there. But my parents had told me, like, we don't make enough money to send the two of you there. So if you want to go to the same school as your brother, you probably should try to get a scholarship. And I really wanted to go to the same school as my brother. So I studied really, 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 really hard. Actually made it, got the scholarship. And then once I was there, I was like, well, mission accomplished. Why do I need to keep studying so hard? Right? I can, like, step off the gas a little bit. So I did, until one day I got a call to the principal's office and he was just like, well, you know, there's certain expectations that come with being a scholarship student, like the school is paying all your fees and they're expensive. So we're not happy with you just being, you know, fourth or fifth position in the class, right? Like you're not pulling your weight. And then, you know, there's a competitive side of me as well. It was a bit embarrassing to have that talk. So I think in my third year of secondary school, I was just like, okay, no more playing around, no more, you know, just taking it easy, doing things as I like, let's actually step foot on the gas. So that's when I like dropped a lot of the extracurricular stuff and like went full in studying, which I liked anyway, right? So I was a library prefect. I enjoyed learning. So it was just like focus now on studying and passing exams and doing well. And I did and had very, very good grades. The year after that discussion, I basically had the highest score in the school's history. I had like the highest score in 7 out of 9 subjects. So yeah, I think they realized then like, okay, fine. This is the scholarship student we were expecting. This is the one that was promised.
I mean, I'm really enjoying this narrative because it very much resonates with me and my experiences of school as well. Like you grew up in a fairly small town that had a couple of industries that were primarily related to oil and gas.
Right.
So most of the people that I went to school with were children of people who worked for, you know, these oil and gas companies.
Right.
But the sort of desire to be the best, being highly competitive, all those things, yeah, massively resonate with me. But I'm curious about, so there's this desire to be successful academically. But what about, other kinds of influences? Because I guess the early influence here was mainly to do with the sciences, right? Because you eventually went on to study engineering at university. But was it just that focus on the sciences? Or were you doing other things? Were you reading other things as well?
Oh, yeah. I've always read lots of different things. For academic study, I focused on science and technology and engineering. But I've always been interested in everything. I basically read my parents' entire collection of encyclopedias by the time I was like 9. And I didn't understand more than 80% of what I read, but I just liked trying to understand, like the process of finding things out. Like I said, I'm curious about the world, right? I like finding things out. So I just kept reading. And yeah, just my mom studied English literature and my dad studied engineering. So there were lots of books on everything in the house, from engineering principles to history to politics to literature classics, and I would read all of them. And even not just literature classics. Sometimes you even have like trashy literature as well. Like my mom did not discriminate, so there was everything in there. And I read all of it from when I was young.
There's a space in life for trashy literature.
Oh yeah, there's space for everything.
Yeah.
I love trashy cinema, trashy literature. There's high art in trashy art as well, right?
Absolutely.
There's an elegance to it.
Yes.
Well, if you know what you're doing.
Yes.
So I think I've been influenced by so many things, but primarily I'd say it's coming from those two axes, which is my dad mostly the engineering, history kind of focused, right? And my mom very much the literature, but also business-minded person. And so from both axes, I kind of like picked up a lot. And that's basically who I am. I always joke that I'm the exact average of both my parents. If you took my dad and my mom and like put them in a blender, you get a smoothie of me, right? Because
what a description.
I'm literally half the, in between their heights. I was in between their weights. I studied engineering like my dad did, but I'm a writer, which links to my mom's, you know, English literature. And in terms of personality, I have bits of my dad, I have bits of my mom. The joke is my older brother looked more like my dad, and I looked more like both of my parents, and my younger brother looks more like my mom. So yeah, I'm the average of both of them. So those are probably my biggest influences, I think.
So you're also the middle child.
I'm the middle child. Okay. That turned out to be the average of both of them. So yes, I'm the mean mode average. Yes.
Okay. But there's nothing average about you, Ole. The encyclopedia thing makes me laugh because I feel like I have all sorts of random facts in my head about everything. Because I feel like you, I'm interested in everything. Like I want to know.
Yeah.
And that's partly because when we were growing up, what we read as bedtime stories and I don't think I've ever said this to anyone before. we would read from the Encyclopedia Britannica. So we had all these like, but it wasn't the adult one. It was the kids one, right? So there were all these stories that were not stories. They were facts or historical facts about things. And so I always have like random facts that can, which is why you and I both like to quiz.
Yes, pub quiz. Yeah, because we both like random facts. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
There's a bunch of them floating around from my childhood.
Yeah. Yes, same. Okay, so you obviously went on, you already mentioned this, you went on to choose engineering as the discipline at university. Can you tell us why you chose that? Because you've just said you're the sum of these two people, right? But why did you go down the engineering path when it came to it?
So it's curious because I have a few theories as to why I chose it. I actually didn't want to study engineering initially. I actually wanted to be a pure scientist. In fact, I wanted to be a nuclear scientist for a while. And then eventually, my dad was a chemical engineer and I ended up studying chemical engineering, but he never actually tried to influence me to study that. He just always said, you know, do whatever you're interested in. And along the way, I kind of figured that chemical engineering was the broadest of the engineering disciplines. So as time went on, two things kind of happened, basically. One was that I realized I did not have a good enough memory to study something like medicine. So I slowly dropped out of that. And I had always been interested in the arts, but I didn't want to study them formally. I liked just being able to read whatever I wanted, appraise whatever I wanted. I didn't want formal artistic training. So basically my options kind of narrowed to either formal science, like chemistry, physics, things like that, or engineering. But I also didn't want to limit myself too much. So chemical engineering was the broadest of the engineering disciplines, right? Because you dig into both chemistry and physics and a lot of math, but also fundamental engineering principles. So I kind of defaulted to that. I was like, okay, I'll pick the broadest one and learn a little bit of everything, right? All the different kinds of engineering. Because again, chemical engineering, you take courses from all the other engineering departments. So I was like, okay, perfect. I can get a bit of everything, right? My curiosity kicked in again. So I ended up picking that. And I think my dad just like secretly snickered and was like, he did it anyway. I didn't even have to influence him. He just did it. So yeah, that's the main reason I ended up doing that. I might have gone into medicine if I had a better memory. Might have been a surgeon or something. But
I don't know. That sounds seems.
But then yeah, you need to memorize so many medical terms. The kinds of exams they do. I don't know how anyone remembers things like that. With engineering, I forget equations all the time. But the good thing is I can always re-derive them as long as I understand the fundamental principles. Sometimes I spend like the first 15 minutes of an exam just deriving equations just so I can use them because I don't remember what the formula is. So it worked for me.
I hadn't thought about it in that way at all. I mean, obviously I didn't study anything remotely related to science. So I do have a good memory, although it feels like it's fading in my dotage.
Maybe more quizzes.
Yes. So obviously you studied chemical engineering. Was your first job out of university an engineer? Were you an engineer?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yes, I was a research assistant in a chemicals manufacturing company for about a year. And then I was a process engineer in an oil and gas construction, well, facilities design company for another year before I did my master's degree and then became a reservoir engineer. So I'm just collecting engineering points along the way.
Clearly. So you've been lots of different types of engineers. But did you, I mean, obviously, was it clear that like, okay, this is something that I will really enjoy doing as a career?
Not so much. Like I said, like picking chemical engineering was more about the breadth of things I could study. And then halfway through, not so much halfway through, but towards the end of the course, I started thinking a bit more practically, like which industry do I go to? You know, where would I be able to make money? You know, what's a practical use for this skill set that I'm acquiring? And that's when I started thinking about the industries available in Nigeria at the time, mostly oil and gas, you know, similar to Malaysia, but also a bit of chemicals manufacturing. So there was some practical element to it. But I've always known that I enjoy being an engineer. I enjoy figuring things out. In fact, that's probably one of the things that drives me, just that makes me enjoy doing my job, even till now, is that feeling you get when you figure something out. Like, there's a problem and we're struggling to understand, why do the results look this way? Why is this piece of equipment behaving that way? And then you take some time, you analyze it, you test it, you come up with an idea, you test the idea. It seems like it's working. You implement it. The thing is fixed. Like, it's a feeling it's like joy, right? And I really, really enjoy that feeling, even despite, you know, having other complications around any kind of job. You might not enjoy the people you work with. Your management might be a bit problematic. But every time I return back to that fundamental of the process of figuring stuff out is always fun for me.
So it's the problem-solving element of
yes.
being an engineer that you like. So, you know, you've been living and working in Malaysia now for over 10 years for, you know, Schlumberger. Are we allowed to mention them?
SLB. Yeah. Is the new, they've rebranded. The company's called SLB.
Oh, fancy. Okay, but how did that happen? How did you end up coming to Malaysia? And, you know, you've lived here now for 10 years.
Yes.
So I want to understand the journey of
okay.
coming to Malaysia.
So the journey starts a bit randomly.
Like all good things.
Like all good stories, you start at a weird angle and then you glide in.
Yeah.
So I had started my second job at the time as a process engineer, designing facilities for oil and gas companies, right? And one of the things that endlessly frustrated me was people would keep changing what we call the basis of design, which is when they tell you how much they expect, how much fluids they expect to come into the facility. So you design based on that, right? If it's a lot, you need bigger facilities. If it's not so much, you need less. And at the time, coming from chemical engineering background, usually this is fairly, it's a fixed number. You know how much you're expecting to come in. In oil and gas, there's a lot of uncertainty. So they don't actually know because everything is underground. And until you start producing, you don't actually know how much will come out. So it used to frustrate me where they would give three or four numbers instead of one. And I would always go have arguments with what we call the subsurface department. Like, why can't you guys decide what this number should be? And they would try to explain it to me and it made no sense. So I was like, you know what? My curiosity carried me. I was like, I will study your discipline so that I understand what you're doing. So I went to do a master's degree in Imperial College in reservoir engineering. And then I understood why things are so uncertain. Without going into technical details, I get it. I'm one of them now that makes those, you know, multiple predictions. Well, it could be this, it could be that. So after I finished studying there, then I got my first job with SLB. Which I never actually wanted to work for initially. My impression of them was they worked mostly in the field, like drilling and things like that, and I wasn't really interested in that part. I was more interested in the design and academic part of things, like coming up with concepts. And then I found out actually they do make software for designing things in oil and gas. And the part of the company that does that was based in Abingdon in the UK. And I did an interview with them and they liked me. So I started working with them, enjoyed it, got to travel to Mexico and a few other places doing things. And the plan was always after about 2 years, I would get transferred somewhere as part of this training program I was on. And eventually it came down to four options. Was Norway, back to Mexico, Malaysia or Angola. I didn't really have a choice. I just knew my manager would pick one for me and they picked Malaysia. And I knew very little about Malaysia at the time, except that I had seen the ads on CNN, you know, Malaysia, truly Asia.
Dear God.
And I was like, oh, that's cool. And then I asked an older colleague, Keith, who had lived in Malaysia for about 20 years before. And he was in Abingdon. I just told him, okay, so they said it's Malaysia. What do you think? And I remember his words really clearly. He just said, don't think, just sign that you would love it in Malaysia. And I was like, wow, okay, that's done. So I didn't even do any research. I didn't even Google the country, nothing. I was just like, done, signed, off to Malaysia it is.
So Keep and Malaysia Truly Asia ads.
Pretty much.
Great.
Yeah. And then I came here. The plan was initially to be here for about 2 years. That was the original discussion. And then either go back to Abingdon or go somewhere else. And let's just say I liked it here. And they liked me here as well. Even now that I'm supposed to leave soon, they still keep giving me things. There's always something. After the 2 years, something else came up. After that, something else came up. And it's like, can you do this? Can you do this? And now it's been 10 years. So it's been 10 good years though.
Yeah. I mean, Malaysia, you know, has many wonderful qualities as a place. You kept your, I mean, I've known you now for 2 years. I did not realize you studied at Imperial College.
Oh, really?
Missed that, key fact.
I mean,
and interestingly, as a company, you know, obviously what we do is send students to study abroad in the UK, and Imperial College is a very popular choice for many of our students. So I'm going to segue a little bit, even though we didn't have mentioned this in our talking points. What was it like studying at Imperial?
Hard. Because I was on a master's program, which is a relatively compressed program. For reservoir engineering in other places, like if you study it in France or in the US, it's typically a year and a half to 2 years. In Imperial, it's done in 9 months. They say it's a year, but practically it's 9 months. The final 3 months are just for like a final year project and then, you know, cleaning up stuff to leave. So you do a lot in 9 months. And the professors all have extremely high expectations. They make no secret of it. Like the day we showed up, they gave us the whole speech of, you know, we received thousands of applications and you guys were selected, so we expect a lot from you. And to give you a sense of the expectations, within, I think, the first month, they would introduce us to concepts. So this is the way it worked. You'd show up in class. On the day, you'd get introduced to a concept. By the end of the day, you would have an exercise on that concept, something you had to do, and then submit first thing the next morning, which means you're literally going to work on it through the night. The thing is, the kinds of assignments they were giving were not simple things. One of those assignments I found out was actually something that had been published in a paper about, you know, in the 80s, right? So at the time, it was considered new discovery. And then now imagine something that had taken people that had been working in the field since the 40s, about 40 years until the 80s, for someone to figure that out and write a paper about it. They introduce us to the concept in the morning, and by the next day, they expect you to have that level of understanding. Something that took someone else 40 years to come up with, they expect you to get it in 24 hours. So yeah, that was pretty brutal.
Yeah, it's interesting. You're not the first person to tell me this about the experience of studying at Imperial. Early on in me coming into this job, we had an academic from Glasgow come to visit, and he was a former student that had applied through us to go to Imperial, and he was now, you know, professor in Glasgow. And he was saying, like, going to Imperial for his undergrad was like literally being thrown off the edge of a cliff, like, you know, sink or swim, basically. So yeah, anyone thinking of going to Imperial College, bear that in mind.
I mean, it was also fun, I will say. Like, you meet great people. I'm still friends with a lot of people I studied with. I learned a lot. Studied a lot, lots of late nights, early mornings, you know, walking through the snow to get to the library in time. There's lots of that, but there's also, like I said, there's the joy of discovery. Like, I think if you have a personality like mine, where you enjoy finding things out, that process of, here's a concept, now figure something out. Mm. Here's another concept, figure something out from first principles. Every time, constantly doing that, it's frustrating, but it's also fun. So, yeah.
Okay. Oh, that's amazing. I like that. So we're also here to talk about this other side of you, Wole.
Right.
You are an award-winning writer, which is wonderful. So can you tell us a little bit about this writing journey? You sort of alluded to it earlier when you mentioned your mum and her influence in your life. But when did you start writing?
Oof. Okay. So When did I start writing? There's two parts to that, two answers to that. Well, two parts to that answer. The first one, when did I start writing, is probably about when I was 9 or 10. Because if you read enough stories, you start wanting to tell stories of your own, right? It's natural human behavior. I say sometimes, like, all writers are just readers that graduated. So I started wanting to write since I was about 9 because I'd been reading a lot. It wasn't very good. I was 9, so understandable.
Cut you some slack.
I remember writing what I thought was a novel, which basically means I wrote something that filled an entire notebook. And I was like, well, it's a book, it's a novel. And I showed it to my mom, and I remember her reaction being like, kind of smiling, but more just like, okay, now be serious with your work, please. Like, this is not it.
So, fair.
That was it. It was fine.
Yeah.
It was what I needed at the time. So I kind of stopped really trying to write after that. Like I said, I focused more on schoolwork at the time, left out all the extracurricular stuff. And then when I was in my teenage years, I kind of got this idea into my head that I wanted to be a film director. I had this whole plan where I was going to be an engineer for about 30, 40 years, retire at like 50-ish, and then take some of the money I had saved and make my own independent movie and do the whole film festival circuit and become famous. Right. That was my plan.
I still think it's plausible.
Maybe. We'll see. It's still on the table. But at the time, I wasn't thinking of writing. I just liked stories. And then when I was in my early 20s, I started trying to write a little bit again. I joined like a drama club and I was writing scripts for drama. And around the same time, my parents passed away. They both passed away in the same year. That was a really, really rough year. And one of the ways I was coping with that was I started writing a lot again. Telling stories, writing like memoir pieces, just creative writing, any kind of writing at the time. And I did a few pieces here and there, published on a few blogs, well, friends' blogs, on my own personal blog at the time. And then it just went from, you know, people would say things like, oh, this is actually really good. You could maybe sell this, or, you know, can we publish this in a newspaper or something? And most of the time it was for free. And then eventually people start offering you, well, we can pay you $5 and maybe 10, something. I'm not sure. And then eventually $5 and $10 becomes like 100 and maybe 200. And it's like, wait, am I becoming a professional writer now? And then I hit, there was a spark that kind of triggered my career, which was around this early period. A friend of mine sent me a call for submissions. Someone was making an anthology of stories of African science fiction. And they knew I'd always been interested in science fiction. And I was writing on blogs. They'd seen my work. There was always elements of science fiction in there. So they said, why don't you submit to this, right? And I did. And initially the story was accepted. But then later it got dropped because the editor essentially said something to the effect of, you have great ideas, but you don't have the literary skill to tell the story effectively. And it would take a lot of editing to polish it and bring out the concept. So I took that as a bit of a challenge, right? This is my whole personality. So, well, if there's something I don't know, I should learn that then. So I started studying writing, creative writing. I got books, as many books as I could, watched videos, whatever was helpful. And I just started writing a lot more. So this was around, you know, 2012 to maybe 2015. It was just trial and error. I would keep writing, submit it somewhere. If it got rejected, I would submit to the professional magazines. And my whole benchmark was, if I could get them to buy one, I know I've reached the level I want. And until that happens, then I just keep learning and trying. So I just kept doing this, grinding away. And eventually started, you know, you go from getting rejections, form rejections, where they tell you nothing except we're not taking it, to, you know, what we call personalized rejections, where we're not taking the story, but we almost did, and this was really good, and we enjoyed this part, but maybe this could be worked on. It's like, okay, that's progress. Now I know what to work on. And then eventually they started buying the stories. And then I started selling more and more, mostly still short fiction, started getting nominated for a few awards, which was surprising, but good. And eventually now I had a collection published in 2019 of some of those short stories, the best of the ones from that period. And now I have a novel out this year. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think people don't realize that simply having ideas or wanting to tell stories doesn't necessarily translate into becoming a writer.
No.
So I read a lot too, and I read a lot as a child, but I never sort of felt the need to write myself. And I think storytelling can come in various ways. I think personally, I'm a better verbal communicator than I am a sort of written communicator, right? But that's besides the point. But I think, you know, if anyone is listening and they want to become a writer, it is a skill that you need to learn and you need to hone. And so I think it's really cool that you were like, right, okay, I've got these ideas, but now I need to learn how to present them in a way that will engage with my audience. But I also think it's great that, you know, Nigeria has this rich sort of tradition of writing and writers, and it's encouraged, isn't it? It's not seen as something that, like, oh, why would you waste your time being a writer? there have been several success stories out of Nigeria. And do you think that's had an influence, that sort of recognition that writing is good and cool and a way to express yourself?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's growing up, like I said, my mom studied literature, but even my aunts and friends and just people that we were with, I think most educated Nigerians value literature. And where that comes from is a combination of the culture itself values storytelling, and also a bit of the colonial legacy of, you know, Nigeria being a publishing hub anyway, right? Especially for English literature at the time. So that has always been supportive. And I mean, I share a first name with the only Nobel Prize for Literature winner from Nigeria, who was also Wale, even though, you know.
Yes, I told someone last night, oh, yeah, I'm going to record one of my podcast episodes tomorrow, and it's with a guy called Wale. And they're like, not that one. I was like, not that
no,
one.
No.
Another one, a very cool, another cool Wale.
Yeah, like the Tesco Value Wale.
Oh, come on, Wale, that's unfair to you. Okay, we'll say he's Waitrose and you can be Marks and Spencers. Are you okay with that?
I'm not even sure which is better. I'd say he's more like Versace and I'm like H&M.
Oh, mate. Oh, yeah. Harsh.
The Nobel Prize speaks for itself. Okay.
Fair enough. You'll get there, though. You'll get there. So you're still, you know, full-time job as an engineer. So how much time do you devote to writing?
A lot. But, okay, so typically my writing approach is I tend to write early in the mornings. For a lot of my writing career, it tended to be very scattershot. Whenever I could find time, you know, on a bus, on a train, on a weekend, during a holiday, just whenever I could find time. But as I've gone along and become a bit more professional and, you know, now people expect me to produce work and not just work, but good work on a schedule, right? I realize I need more of a structured approach to it. So I think from about 2019, 2020, especially during the pandemic, I kind of crystallized an approach, which was I write first thing in the morning, typically between 4 a.m. and 8 a.m. You know, sometimes I wake up at 5, 4:30, whatever it is, and write for about 2 to 3 hours. And then the day starts, right? So as long as I can keep consistent with that, at least 4 to 5 days a week, writing 2-3 hours first thing in the morning when my brain is clear and, you know, I can be as creatively free as I want. I'm not thinking about other things yet. That works for me. And consistency helps a lot. I think I've realized when writing, it can be very intimidating to have a blank page in front of you and think, I need to get to a 100,000-word novel at some point. But if you just stick with it and write even 200 words a day, in about a year or two, you'll be done. You'll have it.
Yeah. It's so my sister is a writer, and I also interviewed her for this podcast, but also obviously I know her because she's my sister.
Right.
So she also has a full-time job, and her approach is very similar.
Okay.
So she wakes up very early in the morning and she writes. And I think for the same sort of reasons of having that clarity of mind, but also consistency.
Yeah.
I think people forget that when you have the sort of aspiration to be a creative, you forget that being creative takes time and effort.
Yeah. And one of the things I love coming back to is there's a really good book on writing, which is called On Writing by Stephen King. But it's part memoir and part like craft book where he teaches certain skills. And one of the things I really took away from that was his notion of, yes, you need to be inspired to come up with good writing and good ideas, of course, right? But you cannot wait for inspiration. You kind of need to create the situation for the inspiration to hit you. And the only way to do that is to be consistent. If you show up every morning at a certain time and you put yourself in front of the typewriter or the computer or your notebook or whatever, the chances of inspiration hitting you are higher. It won't happen every day. Some days you write only 10 words and you come the next day and delete all of them because they're terrible. And some days the inspiration will hit you and you write 1,000 words in 2 hours. But if you keep waiting for the time that you feel inspired, inspiration might hit you in the middle of, you know, being at the gym or while you're eating or while you're talking with friends and you can't do anything with it yet. And by the time you get home and you try to write, it's gone. So you just need to create the environment for the inspiration to hit you. So it's part, it's a bit wishy-washy, but it's part wishy-washiness and part system. And marrying the two, I think, is what helps Stephen King. And it seems to work for me as well.
Like I said, you're not the first writer to say that. The creating a system and, or more like an ecosystem that works for you, is what then brings out the stories or inspires you. My sister does this thing where she goes to the beach that's near our house and just every morning consistently goes there for a couple of hours, and that's where she writes. And that's just her thing. I mean, I say our house, it's when she goes back to visit my parents. Okay, so we're kind of at the tail end now of our conversation. If you look back on your career and, you know, your kind of life choices, is there anything you think you'd do differently?
Absolutely not. And the reason for that is I'm a relatively stubborn person.
No.
Relatively. And I have a certain philosophy about the way I approach my life, which is I make the best decisions that I can, given the information at the time and the situation and the context at the time. So looking back, there might have been better alternatives, but would I have picked them given my emotional state, given the situation and the context? Probably not. I'd probably have done the same thing. So why judge my past self by an unfair standard? And I think that's one thing that a lot of us tend to do. Like, I used to do it. Like, I made a conscious choice to stop and like kind of live, you know, with this eyes forward kind of approach. Because it's unfair to yourself to keep looking back and saying, oh, I should have chosen this option. Maybe in hindsight, it could have been the better option. But what else was happening in your life at the time? Some people say, oh, yeah, maybe I should have gone to gym yesterday. But you didn't go maybe because you were tired. Maybe there was something happening in your life emotionally that you just couldn't make it. Maybe if you had, you would have struggled through it and could possibly even injured yourself because you didn't even feel up to it. We tend to leave all those things out when we look back and we just remember the clean story version of it, which is, if I had done this, I would have achieved X. But there's so many other things around to contextualize decision-making. So it's why I always try to analyze the situation. Whenever something comes up, if I need to make a choice, I make an analysis. And I convince myself that given the situation right now, this is the best choice I can make. We're doing it. We're not looking back. So I'd never really look back.
Yeah, and looking back is not always helpful. I think, I mean, sometimes you do have to learn from your mistakes.
Right.
That's an important, thing to think about. But yeah, regret is unhelpful.
I think so, yeah. In terms of learning from mistakes, what I try not to do is view the past with new information. If there was information available at the time that I didn't pay attention to, that I should have, I treat that as a lesson. I would also try to understand, why did I not pay attention to it? Maybe it wasn't made clear enough. Maybe the way it was presented wasn't concise enough. Maybe there was competing information that seemed better at the time. But all of that becomes the learning. Okay, so next time I need to make sure that all the options are presented clearly, things like that. But the decision, I usually don't second guess it.
Yeah, I'm the same, actually. I kind of look back at things and just go, no, that was the right thing to do at the time.
And I also think life is so random. There's so many things happening in the universe. I don't want to get into my whole cosmic thing, but the universe is so big, so much bigger than us, and so many things are happening on a molecular level that are influencing our decisions that we're not even consciously aware of. So what we have is an illusion of control over our lives. We really have very little control. So that's why I kind of take this approach of, you make the best decision you can at the time and you move on.
Yeah, no, agreed, 100%. There's only a few factors really that you can control. And once you recognize that, I think that's when it becomes easier. So any last thoughts or advice for young people who are considering what they will be when they grow up?
Oof, advice. But, you know, the thing with advice, the problem with advice is it's never universal, right? For almost every axiom or saying that you can come up with, someone else probably has an opposite one that also worked and they can present it with examples. But what I will say in terms of general advice is follow what you're interested in the sense of the things that make you happy as a person. Try to make that into a career or align your career with that. So, for example, I love problem solving. I enjoy figuring stuff out, whether it's in games or, you know, trying to remember something, even though I'd have a bad memory. But when I do figure it out, it makes me happy. So I go for quizzes. As an engineer, I'm constantly presented with problems. I make a joke, like, every day as an engineer is like taking it's like walking into an exam hall where you don't know what the syllabus is. Every day.
It's literally my worst nightmare. It's actually, when I have stress dreams, my actual stress dream is that I'm going to sit for my SPM exam and it's always physics and I haven't studied. That is my stress dream.
Well,
if I dream that, I know I'm highly stressed.
Yeah, that's kind of like my job is I just walk in and I don't know what clients are going to ask. I don't know what problems they're facing and what they need help with. Or, you know, my colleagues will reach out to me for something and I literally don't know, but I will figure it out. Mm. And I enjoy that. So I think if you have that kind of personality, lean into it. Find a career that allows you problem solve. And if you can find one that also pays well, then yes, please do that. That's a good thing. If you enjoy interacting with people, if you enjoy the company of other people, then maybe a career in sales, marketing, where you get to interact with people constantly, that would be perfect, right? But I would say the mistake is trying to reverse engineer the future, which I see a lot of young people do. Even in my office, people ask me, like, so what do you think I should do? Because the industry trend is going this way, and I think this industry might be here in 10 years. This will be the thing people are looking for, so I should start, you know, building a career towards that now. Some of that, yes, you can do it a bit, especially if you're analyzing something in your area of interest. But trying to figure out what you should do now in order to prepare yourself for a career in the future is, I think, self-defeating, because no one knows what the future will be. So many things change in so many different directions. You talk to the experts about what's hot today and what they think the careers of the future will be. In 5 years' time, they'll be saying something else. Another 10 years' time, they'll be saying something else, right? New technologies come, industries change, economics change, policies change. So, yeah, just if you lean into the thing that works for you, wherever you end up and whatever future comes, at least you'll be happy. So,
yeah, I really love that, because I think doing something that is joyful and makes you happy kind of inevitably leads to all the things we talked about. Yeah, I mean, also not being afraid to pursue the wealth aspect of it. Like, I think we shouldn't shy away from that.
Oh, no. But
yeah, thanks so much, Wole, for chatting with me today. I really enjoyed this. I learned a few new things about you, my friend. But I just also want to give a quick plug to your book.
Yes.
Do you want to sort of haul that up and tell us where we can get a copy of it here in Malaysia?
All right. So my book is called, the novel is called Shigidi and the Brass Head of a Balafon. And it is a supernatural heist thriller about a retired nightmare god and a succubus and a reincarnated Aleister Crowley going on a heist to retrieve an object from the British Museum. So that's kind of my elevator pitch for it. It's fun. It's a bit of a globetrotting adventure. It's like James Bond with supernatural elements. Parts of it take place in Malaysia, in Singapore, in Perhentian Island is kind of where the novel kicks off. London, Lagos, Algeria, all over the world. They meet all sorts of creatures and entities. And it's fun, I think, and also a bit introspective about the nature of belief and faith in general. So if that sounds like something you'd like, then yeah, check out Shigidi and the Brass Head of a Balafon. It should be available in Malaysia as from September 15th, especially at Kinokuniya. Kinokuniya in KLCC, they will have signed copies by me because I will be going there to sign a bunch of books, actually on the 22nd. So if you want to buy, hold off until the 22nd and then go to Kinokuniya and buy a bunch of signed copies by me.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, I knew that there were some elements of Malaysia in the book. We've sort of spoken about it.
I've been here 10 years. It has to come. It has to show somehow.
Yeah, absolutely. And how interesting that they're trying to retrieve something from the British Museum, which is going through a very interesting time.
Well, as we say in Nigeria, every day for the thief, one day for the owner. Right. So
absolutely. Yeah. We've promised not to talk about politics or religion. We've touched a little bit on both. But anyway, lovely to have you here, Wole. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Davina. It's been fun. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.